ACCA, the world's most forward-thinking professional accountancy body.
Thank you for tuning in to episode 2 of ACCA's Rethinking Risk podcast series, which is meant to help members navigate the complex, fast-changing, and radically uncertain world we are living in today. I'm Rachel Johnson, Head of Risk Management and Corporate Governance for ACCA's Professional Insights team. And today we are going to talk about the crucial role of the board and risk oversight. Boards all over the world this year have had their resilience, leadership, and corporate governance tested unlike ever before. Whilst there will be lessons learned and indeed opportunities presented, COVID-19 has given them a pounding wake-up call. So there couldn't be a better time than now to introduce you to our next guest, David R. Koenig, who is here to talk to us about his latest book, The Board Member's Guide to Risk. David is a well-recognized global leader in the governance of risk, and I've been very fortunate to know and be privy to his dedicated work in the industry over many years. David is the founder of the Directors and Chief Risk Officers Group, the DCRO, also one of the founders of both the Professional Risk Managers International Association, PREMIA, and the PREMIA Institute. And he serves on the advisory board of the Center for Advancing Corporate Performance. David has held both executive and board positions throughout his career, published books and papers across multiple media channels, and has had responsibility for enterprise-wide risk management programs as well as complex risk-sensitive portfolios. His first book, Governance Reimagined, has been regarded as required reading for senior management and board members globally. And now his new book, released in May, when most of the world was in lockdown, is fast becoming the risk survival guide for boards. I'm nearly finished reading it and have especially enjoyed the true stories he tells to back up his points. But I must also share with our audience a couple excerpts from the many reviews that caught my eye. One is by Carol Gray, a board member at IFM Investors, Board of Governors at Trent University, and a board member at Amex Bank of Canada. She says, "While reading the book, it triggered my thinking on how the boards on which I serve should be considering risk in a post-COVID virus environment. Building resilience through empowerment, speed, and trust was the biggest takeaway for me for the book. I look forward to sharing copies with my fellow directors." There's also, which is happens to be maybe perhaps my favorite, from David X. Martin, the cyber risk expert and special counselor at the Center for Financial Stability, and former chief risk officer of Alliance Capital. He says, "Reading this book was like drinking a fine bottle of wine. I finished it on one sitting. And yes, the book is like a good travel guide. It informs you of what you shouldn't miss on your risk-taking journey." So David, a warm welcome.
Rachel, thank you so much. That was nice to hear that. And I appreciate your reading the book and sharing some of those comments.
Aw, the timing of your book is spot on. And when you think back to April and May and the sheer velocity of the crisis, it's almost unimaginable to think of the pressure board members have been under this year. So I thought I'd start by asking you how you think the pandemic has shined new light on boards' fiduciary duties and how they meet the increasingly complex expectations of different groups of stakeholders.
Yeah, I think, part of this is looking at the way in which the book is set up in the first couple of chapters, because it's really about board relationships. And I want to go into a couple of key items from the second chapter from the book, which are focused on group dynamics and how they can impact our ability to be effective board members. And also, I think, how we can effectively relate to board members. But, you know, I want to back up again and talk about this setup, which is to note that if we focus on risk as loss, we really start to underserve our constituencies. So human biases around the questions framed as loss, which is, I think, when we entered the pandemic, what most people were focused on. has shown, and this is Nobel Prize winning work from people like Daniel Kahneman and Amos Tversky. When we see questions framed in the realm of loss, we don't make very good decisions. We're biased in how our decisions come about, and we really don't make them well. So in our board work, in our work of our organizations, one of the things I think that's really important for us to recognize is this bias, but also to recognize it's not just in us. Our organization's ability to realize all these goals are tied up in our ability to attract capital. And that's in the form of customers, employees, you know, human capital, technology and ideas, this intellectual capital, and even the freedom to act as a form of capital, because that can be restricted by regulators if they're afraid of something that we're doing, or if they think there's something that we do might be causing losses. All of these require some source of funding, right? So we have to draw in financial resources as well. And what we know about those is that they can be drawn to us in a competitive environment, but they can also go away from us very quickly, as we saw in the financial crisis in 08, 09, and to some extent during the pandemic. But what I've tried to do in the book is to encourage this discussion of risk moving away from a focus on loss and really towards something called trust. You know, trust is a word that we throw around quite a bit, but the emphasis on our risk-taking's impact on trust is how it's going to impact our ability to draw capital in from all these different sources. So if I get back to the boardroom dynamic and particularly around threat, I mentioned something in chapter two about groupthink. Mm-hmm. And groupthink, I think, is an expression that many people are aware of. But within the board, you know, it's such a small group. It's a place that's ripe for groupthink to occur. And when we're threatened, again, with this idea of loss, or if we have something like a pandemic, our body's natural reaction is to shut down part of our brain. So the part of our brain that gets shut down is the strategic part, because our brain is telling us what we really need to be focused on is survival. So we have to make quick actions. We can't really be thinking. We're just responding. And when we have issues emerge, again, like the subprime crisis or the pandemic, that start to amplify, these bring on even greater fear for us. So one of the things that I think that the board has to do is to try and structure their processes so that they can avoid this feeling of being threatened, to give people more confidence. And the idea of groupthink comes about, again, because it's a small group, it's focused on the same kinds of things. But the other thing is we have too many commonalities. You'll hear people talk about boards being structured by, you know, inviting the people you know to join you, or inviting people who are like you, inviting people who will fit in. And while there's some comfort in that, one of the things it does is it increases the risk of this groupthink. And groupthink's not just a problem during threat, and not just a problem during crises. It's also a problem when things are going really well. Groupthink is about keeping ideas out of the discussion from people who are outside of the group. So again, if it's problem time and we're being attacked, we don't want to hear anything from anybody else. We're just trying to survive. But if we're in good times, we don't need to hear anything from anybody else because we've been doing so well. So one solution to this is to invite people into our boards who are more diverse, and that's diverse by gender, experience, education, culture. Those are the things you most commonly hear people talking about. But one of the things that I think that, you know, in going through this current crisis is that we're also recognizing that we need to have people on our boards who have a different way of thinking. Mm-hmm. And that can come from cultural experience. It can come from all these other diversities that I've mentioned. But I talk in the book about common ways of thinking that I've seen among board members. One of them is linear, which is I see the future. I see where we're trying to go. We're just going to go there and get it. I mean, that's a very direct way. It's successful often. Then we have people who might consider best and worst outcomes as well as average expectations. But there's this mindset among people who I think understand risk in a way that others don't, which I call stochastic mindset. And that's seeing the future as having myriad possible outcomes. That different way of thinking helps to break groupthink at a board, especially when we're under threat, or again, especially in these times when we think we're doing really well. And so that's, to me, that's a really important way of addressing the next concern. You know, where the pandemic is, you know, people wonder whether the pandemic was a black swan. It wasn't. You know, pandemics have been on the top of people's risk lists for quite some time. Mm-hmm. But if you didn't talk about it, if you didn't have this mindset of it being a possibility, if it wasn't part of your board discussion, then it might have caught you off guard and you might have felt like you were being attacked. And there's a pretty big difference in organizations who were thinking about this in advance that I think comes about when you have somebody who has that mindset of stochastic thinking about the future. And I hope that addresses what you're asking mm-hmm. about, but there are some shifts that are coming that that boards have to take. And I think one of those is changing the way in which they're structured. Again, the diversities that we've talked about in terms of gender and experience, but also in ways of thinking.
Yes, absolutely. Well put. And I do think that throughout the book, in every chapter, there's new types of concepts that you, at least I was introduced to, that really made me think about risk and board composition, for example, as well. So you also provide a lot of great examples of how the lockdown tested board's effectiveness. And I thought the principal component analysis that you talked about in chapter 4 was interesting in terms of building resiliency. And I wondered if you could enlighten our audience about why this is so important in terms of being prepared for those future disruptions and shifts, as you say, and ensuring sustainable growth.
Yeah, I think it's interesting. For me, I kind of think I'll trace this back to my grandfather, who was an engineer and who was somebody who could take apart anything and put it back together. I mean, that was a very strong memory of him as a kid, is just watching him tear anything down and be able to put it back so that it was working again. So in this context, this idea of principal component analysis, I want to differentiate it from the mathematical notion of PCA, because I don't want your listeners to think I'm going to take them down some sort of quantitative rabbit hole of math. What we're really getting back to is an approach to risk governance, which starts with success. So let me take my grandfather example and say we had a broken toaster. So success for my grandfather was that the toaster was working again. In order to understand how that could happen, you need to understand all the things that go into realizing that goal. So with boards, you know, strategic discussions about where we want to go are very common, but understanding the specific drivers that get us to that place isn't always the same or isn't always given the same priority in that discussion. So we're really trying to get back from success, each step saying, what is it that could cause this to happen? What are the first principles of these success? What is it that will drive our customers' needs in the next 2 years' time, for example? And then understand what kinds of things influence their position. So we keep working backward to finer and finer detail to understand what drives them or drives, frankly, any capital provider to be part of the success that we're trying to plan. And then ask, what are we doing in order to enhance those? What are we doing to enhance the things that will make them more likely to provide their capital to us? What is it that we have in place to respond to any shocks to those drivers? So, you know, take a retail setting. What did you expect if you couldn't have people come into your store? Did you have any way of addressing that? What did you have to address if people were afraid to be outside? Had you talked through that in your discussions? And getting back to those first principles gives you a sense of how everything works. These are the finer details. These are the parts. You know, again, sorry to overuse this example, but knowing all the parts in a toaster and how they relate to each other gave my grandfather the ability to put it back together and make it work. There's a company I cite in the book that I think did a nice job of this, and they're a grocery chain in Texas called HEB. Mm-hmm. And they had, as part of their culture, a success for them was being of service to their customer base. So they wanted to be a very reliable provider. Now in Texas, hurricanes and flooding were something that were common enough that the organization had been talking about how to deal with those. But they had also, and I think maybe as much as 10, 15 years ago, considered how they might respond to a pandemic. And so they actually had a pandemic plan. that they had stress tested, excuse me. And they had just run it through a tabletop exercise, I think as recently as a year before the pandemic. So when that happened, they were able to pull out their playbook and say, here's what we do. They did also reach out in these networks that they had to retailers that were in Spain and China and Italy and other places that were ahead of the United States in terms of seeing the impact of the pandemic. And they learned from them. So part of their model in this pandemic plan was to learn from others and bring in new information. And I've had some personal experiences in this area too, where understanding all the key things you need to successfully deliver on what your capital providers, and that includes again customers, expect from you. Mm-hmm. You already have a plan laid out for how you're going to respond to those. And just one last thing I'll point on this is that I suggest in the book that every organization have something called a problem response team or an emerging risk team that has a lot of empowerment to act. And in empowerment to act, I mean, is to act on things that could impact a business unit's performance or the overall organization's performance without needing approval from others. So they can respond to things that are happening in very quick time. If they don't have that sense of first principles, if they don't have this notion of what drives the organization to success, then they're going to be less likely to be effective. So all of what we're trying to do here is to say, how do we understand not just what our product is, but how do we understand what drives all of these people, all of these entities that have to provide us with capital in order to get us to the place of having people buy our product? Mm-hmm. What is it that drives them? And that's what I mean by principal component analysis. It really makes you smarter about your company and its drivers, because you may not be what you think you are. You may not be a cereal company, for example. You may be a company that is perceived as being about child safety or children's health. It's understanding those drivers. I hope that makes some sense.
Yeah, it's really interesting. We've talked a lot about purpose this year, and I think that all your points there really relate to that. And I wanted to ask next is how you think accountancy and non-financial risk disclosures can help boards and senior management better understand their risk profile, especially with the increased focus on ESG and impact and with the developments in the accounting space like TCFD, which is a really risk-focused measure and initiative.
Yeah, And the non-financial elements obviously are the most difficult, or the non-quantitative elements, I think, are the most difficult. There's the old expression, what gets measured gets managed. So to the extent that the work of these entities and these initiatives gets us to a place where we're trying to put some of these more esoteric ideas into measures that people in the boardroom or outside the company or in management can manage and deal with, that's good, provided that they're measuring the right things. Back in 2009, during the peak of the financial crisis, I launched a company called the Governance Fund. And the investment thesis was, if you understand how organizations are governed, that can give you an advantage in portfolio construction. And what I'll tell you is, when I was out pitching this idea, I got a lot of very blank stares because this idea of what governance was or what it meant or whether it had any impact was fairly new, even in the midst of that crisis. But what I try to explain to people is that governance for me goes well beyond the disclosures that you see from companies like MSCI and ISS and some of the others who've tried to put this into quantitative frameworks. For me, I'm trying to assess how a company lives in pursuit of its goals. So you use the word purpose, which I think is a really important one. What is your purpose? But not just what is your purpose, how is it that you're willing to pursue that purpose? What are the things that you're willing to do? And so I wanted to include both financial and non-financial elements as an insight into how companies live. So I had data from companies like MSCI. Sustainalytics does a great job. They go well beyond the numbers, as do a number of others. But what I decided to do was to say, I think maybe going back to my economics training, to say, what is it that the market says about these companies? And I developed something called a market implied governance metric, which I said, it's kind of an intangible. I mean, it's again, putting it into a number. But the idea was to say, what the market, how the market treats a company, is that consistent with this risk profile that's being implied by these other metrics that are coming out of these governance companies? And I use that to develop, you know, again, getting back to numbers, trust ratings and sustainable value grades, which were designed to say, how much should you trust this company? Is this trust that you have in the company already priced into the market? And there's a 20-minute video on my website. I'm happy to direct anybody to it, but it's about this concept of portfolio shaping. And I'll talk about that in just a second. But what I tried to do in this video is to say, let's take some of the most famous minds we have in portfolio construction. And I used Charlie Munger from Berkshire and Carl Icahn and Bill Ackman and George Soros. And I said, okay, let's take these great minds. Let's look at the stocks that are in their portfolio as of this specific date. And then let's see if we can find where they might be making mistakes because they're not looking at this aspect of governance. You know, how is it that these organizations live? And what you find in this concept of portfolio shaping is that almost everybody, even the best people out there, have companies in their portfolio that they may not understand the risk that comes from governance and all these things that we're just, you know, you're talking about some of the climate stuff, these non-traditional accounting measures that get to how an organization lives. Those have an impact on the long run viability of an organization and also on the perceived risk. And that perceived risk might be developing. It might not be there right now. So people look at a company and say they're doing really well. They might have a false sense of security about that. So for me, you know, thinking about entities like SASB how they're trying to bring forward this data. And again, the reporters like MSCI and Sustainalytics, how they're trying to bring forward this data that helps us to actually manage what we're doing more intelligently is really valuable. And I think that where we're going is that capital providers, so this can be the pension plans or other investors or, you know, even employees and unions, they're going to be looking to this data to say, are you an organization that I trust? And you know, is this a relationship that I think is valuable? And so having both financial disclosures through accounting and non-financial disclosures are incredibly helpful in that process. I know we're getting much better at this. You know, you talked about ESG earlier. We're getting much better at understanding this, but there's still quite a ways to go. And so I do think the accounting profession has a big role to play in it.
Yes. And when you were talking in the book, you mentioned earlier about the importance of diverse perspectives.
Yeah.
It was really useful, I thought, in the book, the way you classify and break down the different types of risks. And in chapter 7, no, very useful. And when you talk in chapter 7 about cyber risks, and you note how some risks needs to be addressed differently from a board point of view. Can you explain a bit about the main takeaways in that regard?
Yeah, happy to. And I think cyber and climate are two existential risks that people are paying far more attention to. You talk about, I think, going through some of the typologies of risk. That's a chapter I think I begin by apologizing to people that they have to go through it because it's kind of the boring part of the book. But it's the chapter that helps you understand some of the terminology that people might be using. You know, getting to this idea of big risks like cyber, we can stay with that one, but I think everything we say here relates to climate too. I've always used this concept of a value equation, which is less of an equation and more of an illustration, but it gets to the way in which these capital providers are evaluating their relationship with us. So we're always, in whatever relationship we're in, we're evaluating whether that, you know, it could be subconsciously, but we're evaluating whether that relationship is something that's going to be beneficial. It can be beneficial in non-financial terms. It could be beneficial, you know, because it makes you feel good. But there's still something you're looking for in relationships. And so we have an expectation. And that expectation is forward-looking. And that means that we have uncertainty about that relationship too. So we don't assess the value just on what we expect to get, but we also do some assessment of how likely it is that we're going to be disappointed. So the downside potential of a relationship. But then the other thing is, if it's an ongoing relationship, we're thinking it's going to happen over a period of time. And then if there's a chance that that gets truncated early, that affects the value. So cyber is one of those things that, you know, potentially takes a company out of business or potentially ruins its reputation, you know, for an extended period of time. Because let's say, for example, your private data is hacked, or somebody gains access to your financial data or even to your accounts. Those are things that reduce the value of a relationship. So in the book, you specifically asked about, I think, chapter 7. Mm-hmm. Early in the introduction, you had mentioned this group called the DCRO, or Directors and Chief Risk Officers Group. This is a group of it's a collaborative group of board members and C-level executives. And we're really trying to make it easier for boards to understand how they can address issues like this. And so we've put together four different guiding principles documents, one for risk committees, which I think are necessary any organizations of any complexity at the board level. We've looked at compensation risk. And then the most popular one by far has been the document on guiding principles for cyber risk. And again, that's because I think everybody recognizes that this is something that is potentially an existential threat. So, you know, I would encourage people to go there and look at those documents and try and implement them. The fourth one that's on there, and I'll just mention this one quickly, is something that we talk about, finding a qualified risk director, which is in the spirit of the financial expert that you might find on an audit committee. Those are the people that have that stochastic mindset, but also have some experience with P&L. And they're the ones who can really help us to identify the kinds of risks like cyber and climate and others that threaten what others perceive of us in terms of the relationship we have and the value of that relationship.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And speaking of relationships and also in communicating and collaborating, all these things that I've heard you talk about this year in your own podcast series with other prominent risk commentators is how do you feel boards' relationships with senior risk and financial professionals are evolving or should be evolving as a result of the choppy waters we find ourselves living in today?
Well, you have me worried now that I'm overemphasizing the idea of relationships, but actually I don't think we can overemphasize that.
Yeah.
You know, that's an interesting question. I hope I don't come across as jaded in this response, but I would say that any change in that relationship is still to be determined. And the reason I say that is that, you know, when I talk to board members or if I'm surveying board members, what I'm finding is that there's no lack of recognition that they don't understand risk as well as they need to. I mean, if there's anything the pandemic brought forward, it's that. So you can't talk to a board member right now who doesn't use the word risk in their conversations. But in the past, we've had plenty of crises as well. And so the reliance and interest in risk has risen, and then it's faded away to some extent. And I don't know if that's just because things started to go well again and we were only focused on how risk can be related to the downside. The good news is anybody who brought the idea of pandemics to their boards prior to this crisis has won credibility that will never fade away. I mean, they're fine. That's one of those things that they've just earned that credibility, but that's not gonna be true everywhere. You know, there are frameworks out there for how boards can relate to their institutions. I mean, the DCRO's purpose is exactly that, which is the relationship between the risk function, CRO, Chief Risk Officer, and the director. So that's its name, right? Directors and Chief Risk Officers Group. But one of the other things too is how all these entities relate to the outside. And I think that, you know, boards in their due diligence both need to raise their awareness of risk. So this book, you know, mentioned the Board Member's Guide to Risk. It's a very short book. It's written to be accessible to non-risk people. Mm-hmm. But there's some people who want to go deeper than that. And so there's an ISO document, 31,000. There are things that have come out of the OECD and others. The foundation of the ISO document was that old Australian New Zealand standard.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that those are excellent documents because they look at the organization and say, risk is not just about loss. I think even in ISO, they talk about it in a way that I like to as well, which is a deviation from the expectations. So I get back to that value equation, right? It's a set of expectations in the future. Risk is the deviation from that, which can be positive as well as negative. So what we're really trying to do in these relationships is to get us to a place where we're going to get to a more positive framing, more of a focus on the upside, how it is that we increase the likelihood of large gains in our organization and decrease the likelihood of large losses. Because that kind of future, you know, I talked about portfolio shaping. That's what we're trying to do with portfolio shaping, is make our portfolios look like that in the future. Our organizations are all portfolios. They're portfolios of ideas, of intellectual capital, physical capital, financial capital, human capital. We're trying to shape what the future of those looks like in a way that's more positive. Our relationship back to the organization from the board, I hope, is one that starts to look at risk management, not just on the defense, not just as a defensive tool, but something that helps us with the achievement of upside goals.
Yes, I really thought the bits in the book about taking on risk were really interesting. And at the start of the book, you emphasize that the fear of taking risks is the surest way to realize failure. So I wondered, can you discuss the key governance measures to help boards continuously innovate and create value, and to do that during a time of an unprecedented crisis?
Yeah, and I hope I don't contradict myself too much here, because I'm always hesitant to put too much into measures, although we have to have them. Like I said, what gets measured gets managed, and what we do in the accounting profession and, you know, through all these other providers is to try and put stuff into measures. I do know some colleagues of mine. So let's say, what is it that we need to keep doing? And I want to get to that, I suppose, first here, is that part of it is to recognize that without taking on risk, we're eventually going to go away. And that might sound simplistic. It might just sound like I'm saying, well, of course, it's obvious. If you don't do things, you won't be around. But there are two researchers that I mention in the book, which give us the reason why we need to be taking risk. One of them is Bart Madden. Bart, I'm going to your
knowledge building.
Yeah, to your listeners, I want to strongly urge them to read Bart's book that came out this year. It's called Value Creation Principles. It's really an excellent text. It's heavy. I mean, it's one that you're going to have your brain engaged to read. But Bart and I met a little over a year ago, and we've just enjoyed knowing him over this past year and talking about his ideas. One of the things maybe some of your listeners will be familiar with is something called the cash flow return on investments, or CFROI. That's Bart's creation, and he did that in the late 1960s. So we know Bart's been around for a while. But one of the things that his work was to do was to try and identify something which he calls firm risk, very different from the CAPM idea of beta and relative volatility. And this is probably somewhere where Bart and I have aligned interests or aligned ideas. His notion was that firm risk is anything that threatens your ability to live your purpose. So again, getting back to that word that you had mentioned earlier. And so in his world, he was asking, is there any way to identify whether corporations have some sort of a life cycle? Do they forget about innovation? Do they lose the ability to continue to generate returns in excess of their cost of capital? And one of the things that he found is they absolutely do. They have this cycle where they're earning high rates of return in excess of their cost of capital, eventually through competition or maybe lethargy within the company. That advantage fades away. They get to a place where basically they're earning their cost of capital, and without doing anything more, they start to destroy capital. So his investment thesis looked at where companies were in that cycle. Now, much later than that, in the 2000s, a physicist named Jeffrey West, who's part of the Santa Fe Institute, studied complexity science. Yeah. He's looked at how innovation in cities has allowed cities to live for thousands of years. As he says, even survive nuclear bombs. But companies seem to go away, and mammals, you know, like us, we have a life cycle that ends in death. And so he asked this theoretical question: are companies, which are complex systems of people, more like cities or more like mammals? And what he found is that companies have a life cycle much like mammals. So rapid growth, leveling off, rolling over, and eventually dying. Well, that's exactly what Bart Madden had found, but 40 years earlier. And the two of them, from very different perspectives, have identified a problem that every board should be aware of. And that's, again, this idea of needing to take risk. And it's not just go take risk. It's how do you do it in a smart way? So I think you had mentioned knowledge building, and I'm not going to be able to give it a really deep treatment here. But in Bart's world, you know, you're looking at any obstacle to achieving your purpose, and you're constantly bringing in new information. His is a systems approach. You know, again, Jeffrey West looks at complex systems. Our businesses are complex systems. The capital environment in which we operate, they're all complex systems. There are thousands of them around us. And one of the things this pandemic did was to reveal a lot of these systems to us that we didn't know existed because they had been working so well. So all of a sudden they stopped working, and we saw our dependency on them. I think the idea of taking risks is that, you know, we're trying to create, for lack of a better term, a venture portfolio. I'd mentioned earlier that all of our companies are portfolios. Mm-hmm. But venture portfolios are ones that take lots of risks and actually expect most of them to fail. And if you went into a room and said, you know, here's my business plan, most of what I do is going to fail, you're probably going to get tossed out because that's not our mindset. But the truth is, venture capital funds do better on a risk-adjusted basis than most companies do, because their mindset is none of our risks are going to be big enough to knock us out of business. And if 2 or 3 out of 10 succeed, they'll succeed so well that the overall result is a positive one. And I worked at a company once that had that same mindset. They had this notion of rampant incrementalism, which meant you're always taking small bets. And you're always then, when the ones that work, you're reinvesting in them, you're expanding them, you're copying them and using them in other places. And the ones that don't work, you truncate the loss. And the result is, again, this reshaping of the future. So for me, boards in terms of thinking about risk need to get to this place to say, one, it's necessary. So don't be afraid of it. You have to do it. Otherwise, you're going to go away. But then also understanding that there are good ways to take risk. And this is where people in accounting and risk management can bring measures in to help with this. It's this is maybe coming full circle to the idea of principal component analysis, but the idea of understanding all these drivers and gaining the confidence to allow people to take risk in a framework that gives them a certain amount of freedom, while you also validate things through internal audit and other sources. It results in getting out of what Bart Madden showed most companies go through, and Jeffrey West in his analysis of why cities survive also talks about this form of distributed authority that leads to greater and greater innovation. So it's really important for us to be thinking quite differently about risk on the positive side.
Yeah, so I mean, that was really interesting, David. I just thought chapter 8, that whole, it is quite deep, but about Bart's book, and well, it's all about innovating and building resiliency in the end. And I think our members will enjoy learning from that chapter for sure.
Thank you.
And also, I just wanted to touch on too, before we wrap up, is one thing I thought was interesting this year, and I've heard you speak with some of our friends in the risk industry about this, is how different the different responses to risk and fear there have been across countries and cultures. And also, I know your book is being translated in different languages, in Russian and in Indonesian. And so I was wondering if you could talk about how the book would be relevant to different countries and different sectors.
Yeah, thank you. No, I'm really happy about it. So as you mentioned, the Board Member's Guide to Risk is being translated into Bahasa in Indonesia and to Russian, and I think both of those are coming out this month. And the group that's doing the translation of that book into Bahasa is also translating the Governance Reimagined book, which is the first book, and I think that's coming out even this week. So I'm really thrilled about that. I mentioned earlier that the book is written to be highly accessible. And what that means is it's non-technical. I mean, there's that chapter three, which, you know, you get to the start of it and I tell you, okay, here's stuff you have to know. It might be painful, but here's what you have to know. I try to make that book non-technical. And the very first book I've tried to keep non-quantitative other than that value equation that's in there. And the reason is that the approach that's being taken is something designed to be applicable to nonprofit, and even government entities, not just government-run enterprises, but political economies. And it's structured because it recognizes that culturally, and then also depending on the time in which you're doing this assessment, you may have a very different view of risk and how you respond to it. So one of the examples is that some cultures socialize risk and other cultures emphasize the individual being the bearer of risk. That's a pretty stark example. Some entities want more control, or some cultures within an organization or country want more control. Others want far greater freedom. So the model that I've designed, and this will go, it's referenced in the second book, but it's really built out in the first book, is this notion of a networked and distributive governance of a commons. And I won't take you deeply into that other than to say it's covered in there. But the whole idea of that is that you can structure that governance model to adapt to any culture or any expectations or any change in the environment. Michelle Gelfand, who was one of the guests on the podcast that you had mentioned, is a professor of sociology or social psychology. And she noted how cultures change in response to threat. Tight and loose cultures are the expression that she uses. When we're under threat, we tend to want more control and tight cultures. Otherwise, we might have a culture that emphasizes the ability to have lots of individual freedoms and experiment. So that's a loose culture. This governance model allows for that to happen. And in some of my more recent writing, I'm starting to put out this idea of what I call nested freedom. And nested freedom is a concept of how things that are part of our lives restrict us to fully live out our potential. So an organization has the potential to do lots of things, but there are all sorts of restrictions on that potential. Some of them are good. I mean, some of them are really important restrictions, but they come through our engagement with all of these different complex networks. Part of what our boards need to do is to understand what the organization is doing that could be restricting this freedom in ways that they don't want it to be restricted. And that can come through too much hierarchy in the organization. It can come from too many rules around protecting brand and images and things like that. But what we're really trying to get to is a place where the board can communicate to the organization the objectives it has, the rules for pursuing those objectives, and then distributing the authority out to take risk as closely as we can to the capital providers. And that requires then that the board have some ability to get information back, whether it's through the accounting function, internal audit, risk people, or as I recommend, people outside of the company telling them about their perceptions. That's the way in which our culture, regardless of what it is, can thrive and be realized in the way in which the organization lives. So again, getting back to this idea that governance is how you live. It's not just, do you have the chair of the CEO separated? Do you have, you know, X number of people on your board that are independent? Those are other things that go, you know, they're more metric based than how an organization lives. But we're really trying to get, how do we live in pursuit of our purpose, which, you know, you had mentioned earlier.
Yes, I mean, as always, very thoughtful insights, David. I mean, the Board Member's Guide to Risk has so many really fascinating human concepts and applications, I thought, too. And now this we can look forward to the nested freedom as well. So I guess that's our sneak peek into what your next book might be.
That is correct. That's part of, I think, chapter two in the next book. I did write a little article on it on Medium in the political context, but I'm going to try and put something out fairly soon about this idea of nested freedom in the governance concept, and really in the realm of innovation, because that's what it's about. It's about allowing people to realize their potential.
That's fantastic. Well, I can't thank you enough for your time. And as always, as I said, fantantic insights and lots of takeaways today.
You're kind, Rachel. It's nice to be with you. Yeah, I appreciate the invitation to join you.
Yeah, we look forward to having you back.
This podcast was brought to you by ACCA. Find out how we think ahead at accaglobal.com.